Case number 29988, Ray versus Kapiolani Medical Specialists. Arguing for the appellant and cross-appellee, Kenneth Robbins. Also appearing for the appellant and cross-appellee, John Anderson Meyer and Andrea Gauthier. Arguing for the appellee and cross-appellant, Robert S. Peck. Also appearing for the appellee and cross-appellant, Philip Rosati and Colin M. Fritz. Argument on the merits.
Good morning, everyone. We have just a preliminary matter that I'd like to address, and that relates to the pro hoc vice admission of Robert Peck. The order that authorized or approved his admission as a pro hoc vice counsel required a filing of a notice of payment of attorney registration fees within 10 days of the order, and that payment didn't occur in a timely manner. By the terms of the order, if the notice of payment isn't filed in a timely manner, that order is void. So at the moment, we don't have an active or valid order of admission for Mr. Peck. And I'd like to ask Mr. Fritz, who's local counsel for the plaintiffs, if you have wished to make a motion at this time regarding Mr. Peck's status.
Yes, Your Honor.
Okay, please go ahead. Thank you. Mr. Robbins, do you have any response or objection?
No.
No objection?
No.
Okay, thank you. Are there any objections from the members of the court or concerns from the members of the court or desire to hold a conference on this matter?
No.
There being none, the motion is granted. So, Mr. Peck, you're admitted pro hoc vice for the purposes of this matter. Now, it's my understanding that counsel has agreed to divide their time with Kapiolani as the appellant going first for 25 minutes, reserving 5 minutes for a rebuttal. The plaintiffs will go next, Mr. Peck arguing 25 minutes and reserving 5 minutes for rebuttal at the end. Is that correct? All right. Mr. Robbins, do you wish to proceed? Thank you. And it's also my understanding that you'll be covering all issues during your 25-minute period. Is that correct as
well? I hope so.
Yeah. But yes, not just the appeal,
yes,
the cross-appeal as well. Same
that
for
is
you,
correct,
Mr.
Right.
Peck. Okay. Thank you very much. Please proceed.
Thank you. May it please the court, Mr. Peck, Mr. Rosati, Mr. Fritz. It's an honor to be back before this court. The last time I argued before this court was 37 years ago when Baird Kidwell was on the bench and asked me the most difficult question that anybody could have asked me. My intention this morning, and of course I expect some detours in the road because I expect some questions this morning, but my intention this morning is to discuss our appellate issues first. By ours, I mean my clients, Kapiolani Medical Specialists, and that is the judgment as a matter of law, as being erroneously put in place by our trial judge, and secondly, the informed consent issue. I will then move to the constitutional issues posed by, and I'm going to refer to them as plaintiffs, and I hope you don't mind that, because we're both appellants and appellees on various issues. I do not intend to address the sanctions issue. I don't think that it's worth spending time on that. And also the pretrial judgment order, and namely Judge Kim denied plaintiff's motion for prejudgment interest. I don't intend to touch on that, but obviously if you wish to ask me questions about those issues, you're more than welcome to, and there isn't much I can do about that if you choose to do so. This court, in my judgment, should not get to the plaintiff's constitutional attack on the cap on damages for pain and suffering because, at the very least, this case should be remanded for a new trial. And even prior to that, it is my opinion that this court, rather, should enter judgment in favor of a defendant for my client for the reasons which I will express in a few moments. In the event this court does not enter a judgment in favor of KMS, this case should be remanded for a new trial. This court in Miyamoto versus Lum et al. 104 Hawaii 1, a 2004 case said, and I'm quoting, a motion for judgment as a matter of law may be granted only when after disregarding conflicting evidence, giving to the non-moving party's evidence all the value to which it is legally entitled, and indulging every legislative inference, I'm sorry, every legitimate inference, which may be drawn from the evidence in the non-moving party's favor, it can be said that there's no evidence to support a jury verdict in his or her favor. Looking at what the jury did in this case is very logical and is based on the evidence. You'll recall we did not attach the jury verdict form to our briefs, but it's part of the record. The jury in this case found my client, Dr. Yamamoto, negligent, but found that her negligence was not a legal cause of any harm to Alyssa Ray, who was the pediatric rheumatology patient in this case. Judge Kim concluded that there was no way that a reasonable juror could have found no legal causation with respect to what the jury found as Dr. Yamamoto's negligence. And Judge Kim was wrong, and I'll tell you why. I believe that the jury did a very sophisticated thing. There was abundant evidence in this case that the treatment plan that Dr. Yamamoto put in place was for 4 weeks of pulsing with steroids. I'm not going to go into the factual basis of this case and how serious Alyssa Ray's lupus was. It involved the brain and other organs, and I think we and our plaintiffs laid that out quite well. But in any event, Dr. Yamamoto, after reaching the diagnosis of lupus, put in place a treatment plan which called for pulsing the patient on three consecutive days for 4 weeks. The jury found that that was negligent. Looking at the evidence on negligence and causation.
Mr. Robbins, did the jury find that the prescription of the four pulses, do you know that the jury found that the prescription of the four pulses was negligent, or could they have also found that the administration of the three pulses was negligent?
Drawing the inference, I don't know.
Okay, did you argue to the jury that the prescription of the four pulses was negligent?
I did not argue that prescribing four doses was negligent.
I'm sorry, did the, excuse me. Did the plaintiffs argue that, or did?
Yes, the plaintiffs argued that it was negligent of Dr. Yamamoto to prescribe the 4 weeks of pulsing of steroids, and it was negligent for her to, in fact, administer 3 weeks of pulsing, which is what, in fact, she did. There was no question about that. She put in place a plan for 4 weeks, but only administered 3 weeks.
Mr. Robbins, that argument was made in the context of informed consent, though, was it not? And if so, is it possible to argue that the plaintiffs made that argument in the informed consent context, but they really didn't make it in the context of negligence?
It's possible to argue that, but I believe what's important here is looking at Miyamoto and drawing all the reasonable inferences, all legitimate inferences that we can from the evidence in this case. I believe that the jury doesn't have to listen to the arguments. They can turn us off completely, as you know, during closing arguments. They can ignore all the expert testimony in the case, and by golly, they're entitled to form whatever the conclusions they want to, which are reasonably based on the evidence.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, Mr. Robbins, but I appreciate that focus about just what was going through the jury's mind, and I wanted to get your guidance on what was going through the jury's mind, you believe, when they did make this determination about the legal causation that did result in damages under the informed consent analysis. Specifically, what was the condition, the medical condition that, in your view, the jury found the plaintiff was suffering from as a result of the lack of informed consent?
Muscle weakness.
And was it muscle weakness from a particular cause?
The evidence was,
I'm asking you, because you were there.
I sure was.
I appreciate that you sat through that trial for so long, but what do you think the jury was considering the cause to be of that muscle weakness when they made the finding that the plaintiff was injured through the lack of...
I think by the time the jury heard Dr. Bernstein's two additional elements under informed consent, namely as Dr. Bernstein testified.
Well, I don't want to divert you too much. I just want, my specific question was, do you think the jury was considering at that point that the condition the plaintiff suffered was as a result of lupus or as a result of the application of steroids?
They could have been thinking either way, Your Honor.
All right. If you were to assume that it was lupus, help me through the analysis that said that the lack of informed consent would have actually caused injury legally if the reason for the injury was lupus rather than the application of steroids.
Well, if that's the case, then the application of informed consent really doesn't apply here at all. Then there would be no breach of my client's duty with respect to informed consent.
All right, and so taking it back to what the jury actually decided, they did decide that there was a breach under informed consent, and therefore wouldn't it be logical to assume that the condition they were identifying as an injury was a condition that was caused through the application of steroids?
Yes, that's one logical inference that can be drawn.
If you accept that proposition, then when you move to trying to explain the so-called inconsistency between the negligent finding and the lack of cause, doesn't that give you some perspective on what the jury was thinking, that actually the negligence there arose from the application of steroids, and perhaps the jury was coming up with a theory that the causation that did occur was a causation that occurred as a result of the result of the negligence? More specifically, wouldn't that decision be able to be explained by the fact that the jury found that negligence occurred, but the actual cause wasn't negligence, the actual cause was a lack of informed consent, so the plaintiffs shouldn't even have gotten to the point where they suffered a particular treatment. If they had been given informed consent, there wouldn't have been any treatment, and therefore the real cause, from the jury's point of view, was lack of informed consent, and really the subsequent treatment wasn't that relevant because it shouldn't have happened. I go through this belabored questioning because I know that we're theoretically supposed to be looking at whether this, using the abuse of discretion standard, and whether the trial judge, and I understand trial judges are overworked and easily distracted. So I'm asking you, since you were there, if the trial judge's determination along those lines that actually the jury did mean that the negligence caused the injury was somehow inconsistent with this finding of no consent.
Well, Judge Kim did state on the record that he felt that the two findings were inconsistent. If indeed, on the one hand, it was the steroids which caused the harm, and the jury found, however, that there was no causation, and on the other hand, he's saying, well, wait a minute, the jury found that there was lack of informed consent, but there was causation there, and he said, these findings are inconsistent, therefore, I, as a matter of law, am going to interpose my own answer in place of the jury's on the legal causation issue. And as I was starting to get into, and I've only got about 12 minutes left of my argument time here.
Mr. Robbins, I hate to interrupt you, but now that we're on the subject of informed consent and the issue of causation, what is your position as to whether the curative instruction which was given by Judge Kim when he struck Dr. Bernstein's testimony, was that effective or not?
That was not effective. That was not appropriate. Something that we did not point out in our briefs, and I'm going to hold these up for you, and I don't mean to insult you by doing this, but Dr. Bernstein's two additional elements were incorporated in 46 questions and 46 answers. Dr. Bernstein gave his testimony on informed consent on January 21st. I objected immediately when he added the two additional elements, and the way he testified to it was very compelling. After going through the usual five elements of informed consent, he said, and the physician needs to tell the patient or the parents about what knowledge is available in the medical literature from medical meetings. And not least important is the doctor's own experience with that particular treatment. Because if the doctor has a lot of experience, and she or he is much more likely to know exactly what to expect with that treatment and what complications there might be of the treatment. Whereas if the experience is very limited, then that, in my mind, would automatically make the things, make the risks greater. I objected right away. We had a bench conference. The judge said, I'm going to overrule your objection. The next morning, we filed a motion for mistrial or in the alternative to strike that evidence. That was denied. As a matter of fact, at that point, Judge Kim said to the jury, after I objected again, I'm going to allow him to answer those questions for the most part because he has been qualified as a doctor in this area. So now I've got the two additional elements going to this jury 46 times over the course of the next several weeks in trial. And if we take a look at the transcripts, every one of those pink slips in those trial transcripts represents a question posed and an answer given with respect to those two additional elements. Mr. Meyer, my associate, said, Ken, when you argue, please don't talk about the bell being rung, and you can't unring it once it's been rung in the courtroom. Well, this bell was rung 46 times. And by the time the jury, we came down to closing argument, which was about a month after Dr. Bernstein gave his testimony, and after 46 questions and answers with respect to the two additional questions, and the testimony was very, very compelling. And this is why we moved from mistrial. To hear a parent, as Mr. Ray did, and as Mrs. Ray did, testify that they would have, of course they wanted to know what the doctor's experience was with this particular treatment. Of course they wanted to know what the medical community's experience was with this particular treatment. And logically it makes sense. I mean, I as a parent would want to know that too. I would ask the physician those questions to elicit that, but that isn't what the law requires. And so, Your Honor, it's my strong belief that no matter that the curative instruction that was given in no way could negate the harm that had been done over the course of almost 4 weeks from the time that Dr. Bernstein gave his testimony and the time that so-called curative instruction was given.
Mr. Robbins, just so I can put this argument in context, nevertheless, your argument is that really the plaintiffs as a matter of law couldn't make out an informed consent case. Aside from that issue, the issue that they did reach the jury on, which was the dosing in a lesser amount, is not something that the doctor was required to disclose, as long as she disclosed the nature of the harm that Ms. Ray was subject to.
Correct.
Is that correct? So we wouldn't reach this issue if we agreed with you on your in essence, your bigger issue, which
correct.
Is, can you talk a bit about that?
If the judge considered these two findings as being irreconcilable, and that's what he put on the record. As a matter of fact, Mr. Rosati didn't even move for sending the jury back for further deliberation to try to reconcile these two apparently disparate answers. And the jury was discharged. The judge said, I'm going to enter yes on the question of causation, and that now we've got a verdict form that is reconciled. And so he discharged the jury at that point. And here we are, as the Miyamoto case says, and you're, I'm sure, well familiar with the Miyamoto case that only came down a few years ago. Miyamoto case says, and that was a medical malpractice case, if there are indeed two irreconcilable portions of a verdict, and the jury is not asked to return or told to return to try to reconcile the two irreconcilable verdicts, then a motion for a new trial must be granted. And that's black letter law in the Miyamoto case, and that follows a long trend of cases. As far as evidence which supported no legal cause, I'd like to get back to that for a moment, if I may. Dr. Pasquale, a board-certified pediatric rheumatologist, testified that the actual dosage administered by Dr. Yamamoto was a standard protocol used in her program. Dr. Panero, another board-certified pediatric rheumatologist in the mainland, testified that the three-week protocol which was administered, not the 4 weeks which was put in place, but the 3 weeks that were administered, was a standard protocol which she had learned during her fellowship. Dr. Panero testified that she has treated hundreds of patients using the three-week protocol, and none have developed any form of permanent muscle weakness as a result. And that's February 12th, pages 30 and 31 of the transcript. Dr. Yamamoto testified that she had learned the three-week protocol from a Dr. Chester Fink, who everybody agreed was one of the pillars in the previous generation of pediatric rheumatology.
Mr. Robbins, I'm sorry to interrupt you, but if you accept the proposition that there's substantial evidence to support your position, essentially that there was a cause other than the negligence, I guess, for the injury, does that assume that the injury was a result of something other than the application of steroids?
It could.
It could, but is it... I'm just interested in whether you're concluding with that argument that the jury found that the injury was not a result of the application of steroids, but it was the natural sort of progression of lupus.
I don't know what the jury was thinking, obviously, because we didn't give them questions that would help enunciate that.
Is that not significant? In other words, if for your argument to prevail, it doesn't matter whether the determination of the jury was that the condition was from lupus or from steroids?
I think what matters for the ruling in favor of my client in this case is that the jury was so confused on the issue of informed consent, and that having rung the bell 46 times, and the judge not striking Dr. Dannon's testimony, a causation expert who testified that in his opinion, over my objection, multiple objections, in his opinion, and this was improper, and I raised this issue at the time, and we did not stress this in our briefs, but in my opinion, it was improper to call a medical expert to testify, as Dr. Dannon did, and he's a neurologist, pediatric neurologist, a causation expert, to testify that assuming Dr. Bernstein's testimony was correct, given informed consent, including the two additional elements of informed consent, assuming that, the only causation expert who testified at trial said, yes, in my view, the lack of informed consent was a legal cause of Alyssa Ray's injury.
But that was an assumption, right? Didn't he explicitly say in his testimony that he was assuming it as a hypothetical? And then the court instructed the jury that that underlying hypothetical set of facts was stricken from the record?
He was asked to assume that. Okay. Correct. But when you have a medical expert testifying that this was a legal cause, the lack of informed consent was a legal cause of injury, that's very difficult to ignore, particularly, as I say, when Dr. Bernstein's two additional elements went before the jury 46 times. So getting back to your question, it is my opinion that the jury was totally confused on the informed consent issue. There was no curative instruction which could have resolved the jury's confusion. Hearing Dr. Dannon testify that yes, assuming that Dr. Bernstein testified that there was a lack of informed consent, in my opinion, that was a legal cause of Alyssa Ray's injury, there's no way that I, at that point, was able to overcome the erroneous testimony and the error which Judge Kim had acknowledged. And Judge Kim was very open about the fact.
Was that the only causation question asked of Dr. Dannon?
Now, he was asked whether the steroids, in his opinion, caused the steroid myopathy, the muscle weakness.
Okay.
And he said yes. So there were two prongs to his causation testimony.
Right. Following up on that question, was there ever any expert testimony that something other than steroids caused the condition?
No. No. As we pointed out in our briefs, Dr. Yamamoto warned of the very risk that eventually materialized. And if you look at Barkai versus Beachwee, another recent case of this court, the court will see that under the Barkai case, it says 98 Hawaii 470, 2002 case, claims for negligent failure to obtain informed consent typically arise when a plaintiff alleges that the physician failed to warn the patient of a particular risk associated with the procedure and the particular risk ultimately occurred. It was conceded by Mr. Rosati at trial. If you look at the settling of the jury instructions the 2 days before closing argument, you'll see he conceded that that his clients were warned of steroid myopathy. Under Barkai versus Beachwee, there cannot be a lack of informed consent if the physician warns of the very outcome that occurs, number one. Number two, plaintiffs have come forward with no case whatsoever saying that a different dose of the same medication constitutes an alternative treatment. So it's our opinion, as a matter of law, all the elements of informed consent were met, all the ones that appear appropriately in the statute and under Barkai versus Beachwee, and also the fact that the patient was warned of the very risk that eventually occurred, and that using a different dosage of the same medication has never been found in any case to have constituted an alternative form of treatment. So it's our opinion that because the JMOL was granted improperly and that all the elements of informed consent were met here, that as a matter of law, judgment should be entered for my client. May I turn? I've got 2.5 minutes left of my argument. I'd like to talk for a moment about the plaintiff's attack on the cap. In a nutshell, Del Rio, Prey versus Judicial Selection Commission says that legislative enactments are presumptively constitutional and that a person attacking a statute on the basis of a constitutionality has the burden of proving, and I'm quoting, unconstitutionality beyond a reasonable doubt. The constitutional defect must be clear, manifest, and unmistakable. That type of case did not exist in Illinois. And in the best case and the LeBron case, which came out, unfortunately, in 2010, I think it's important to note, we did not note this in our briefs, that the Illinois Constitution, formed in 1870 and ratified in 1970, contains a special legislation clause which says special legislation is unconstitutional. We do not have that provision in our Constitution. Plus, that court looked to data before the legislature and said the data that they looked at was erroneous. Again, the Del Rio case says, your case, your decision says that we do not look at data of the legislature to determine whether or not it was appropriate legislation. So for those reasons, those two cases are in opposite. They are distinguishable from any holdings of this court, and I would submit that there is a reasonable basis for the purpose of the medical malpractice tort reform as set forth in our brief on pages 9 and 10, and I will save the remaining few moments I have for rebuttal. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Robbins. Mr. Peck.
Mr. Chief Justice, and may it please the court, it's an honor to appear before you. I will first address the defendant's appeal, and then I will get to ours. 14-year-old Alyssa Ray, a bright, vivacious, athletic young woman, came to Hawaii with her family for a dream vacation. Unfortunately and tragically, it turned into a devastating nightmare that will haunt her for the rest of her life. Alyssa suffers from lupus, an autoimmune disease that is treatable and with which she can lead a normal life. But while here, she needed treatment. And as you heard, the treatment went tragically wrong. What was prescribed was an extreme, unprecedented, intense steroidal regimen that changed her into a scarred woman, unable to care for herself, unable to pick herself off the floor if she falls, and whose intense hospitalizations and rehabilitations have only been able to restore minimal muscular control, a control she nearly lost entirely in light of the treatment she received. The jury's verdict in this case can be sustained either on the negligence count, which was granted as a matter of law, or on the jury's informed consent verdict. As to causation, the defendants have suggested lupus or some phantom disease may have caused her myopathy. This is insubstantial and fanciful. Overwhelming evidence established that this was steroidal myopathy.
Did any expert testify that the lupus without the steroids could have caused the myopathy?
No expert testified to that. Instead, what every expert did was test for the possibility that lupus was the cause of the myopathy, and it was scientifically eliminated. Every single expert testified to that. Each uniformly and consistently said that this was a result of the steroid treatment. The only other type of myopathy that was discussed at all was ICU myopathy. From staying in an ICU, your muscles atrophy, and you have some weakness in those muscles. But, of course, this was the result of the steroid myopathy, which caused her to have to stay in the ICU, and under the state's precedence, that is not an intervening cause. That is part of the original proximate cause of the steroid treatment. Now, what we heard today is that basically the defendants are asking this court to speculate that it could have been something else. Clearly, the judge sitting in the courtroom setting, hearing the same evidence that the jury heard, understood that the overwhelming evidence supported this. And it boggles the mind that it could be anything else, and that the jury might have considered anything else. In fact, this is the jury form. Question one was Dr. Kara Yamamoto negligent in that she breached the applicable standard of care in her treatment of Alyssa Ray? The answer was yes. If you answer yes, you go to the second question. Was the negligence of Dr. Kara Yamamoto a legal cause of injury to Alyssa Ray? And the answer is no. So we have no information. We can only speculate. And as I said, the evidence was overwhelming. As to the informed consent issue, defendants make a remarkable argument that the statute doesn't mean what it says. Twice, in two separate provisions, the informed consent statute says that you must inform of recognized alternative treatments and procedures, and then separately, in a separate clause, recognized benefits of recognized alternative treatments and procedures. This is not optional. And no amount of legislative history, which we're given very generalized legislative history, can overcome the textual command of the statute. And to say that Barkai says otherwise is actually to mislead the court.
Mr. Peck, if I could interrupt, what do you have to say about Mr. Robbins' position that there is no case law saying that a lower dosage of the same medication can ever be an alternative means of treatment?
There's no case law that says that it is not an alternative. In fact, I would say that what the legislature clearly adopts is the standard of care within the medical profession. The medical profession says that these are alternatives. Every expert testified that these were alternatives. Dr. Yamamoto conceded that this was a reasonable alternative. And what the defendants say is that you shouldn't take what doctors say because they think any slight variation is an alternative. But the only thing the statute recognizes is recognized alternative treatments and procedures, and that's what was testified to, and there was no objection.
So under your theory, would Dr. Yamamoto have to go through the, I think there are at least four different regimens that are indicated in the record. Should she have gone through all four?
She should have gone through all of them that were applicable in this situation, and in this situation all four were. She should have. We know for a fact that a medicine, and it doesn't take a medical degree to know this, a medicine that in a low dosage can have a salutary effect can also have a disastrous effect in the high doses. You know, and so that's part of what this is. If you're talking about risks and benefits, you're going to have to talk about, well, you know, we could do it this way or we could do it that way. There's a lower risk here, maybe a higher percentage possibility, but it is for, in this instance, Alyssa's parents to make that decision. And every time they were given an opportunity to go for a less risky treatment, they opted for that. So that's one reason why we think that not only is the evidence overwhelming here as well, that there was a violation of informed consent, but there's nothing in the statute that says otherwise. In fact, the paragraph before, the one that defendants quote in their brief from Barkai, says the elements of informed consent commonly consist of ensuring that the patient consents to the prescribed procedure only being after being made aware of, one, the condition being treated, two, the nature and character of the proposed treatment and surgical procedure, three, anticipated results, four, recognized possible alternative forms of treatment, and five, recognized serious possible risks, complications, and anticipated benefits involved in the treatment or surgical procedure, as well as the recognized possible alternative forms of treatment, including non-treatment. So that is in Barkay. There's no inconsistency between the case law and the statute, and the jury's verdict on informed consent ought to be sustained.
I'm sorry to interrupt you, but before you leave that subject, could you respond to the issue that Justice Duffy brought up about the striking of the testimony of Dr. Bernstein? Once that testimony was stricken, what evidence is left to support the conclusion that there was a lack of informed consent?
Well, there was overwhelming evidence that various alternatives existed, that four alternatives existed, and that these should have been offered to the parent. Every doctor, every expert qualified, said so. And as I said, Dr. Yamamoto agreed that these were reasonable alternatives. Now, the fact is also, as to Dr. Bernstein's testimony.
I'd like to leave that point, and I think that Mr. Robbins had noted the number of times, I guess over 40 times, when the testimony that was stricken was actually referred to in the testimony of the expert that said that there was not.
Prior to it being struck.
How would you respond to the notion that that so infected the jury's analysis?
Well, first of all, again, I would go to the question presented to the jury on informed consent. Question three, did Dr. Carol Yamamoto fail to disclose to the parents of Alyssa Rake at least one of the following? A, the condition to be treated. B, the description of the proposed treatment or procedure. C, the intended and anticipated results of the proposed treatment or procedure. D, the recognized alternative treatments or procedures, including the option of not providing these treatments or procedures. E, the recognized material risks of serious complications or death associated with proposed treatment or procedure, with the recognized alternative treatments and procedures, and as well as not undergoing any treatment or procedure. And F, the recognized benefits of recognized alternative treatments or procedures. Nothing about experience in there. And the jury answered yes. One of those was violated. So experience did not affect the answer to that question.
But couldn't the jury have thought that experience was a component of one of those factors?
I don't believe so for two reasons. Number one, at the time the original objection was made on the 21st, the judge gave a cautionary instruction to the jury that informed consent under the law is what I will tell you what it is and not what Dr. Bernstein says. So he gave them that right up at the start so that they would receive his information in that light. Second, he gave the curative instruction, a curative instruction that defense counsel in closing read to the jury again to emphasize, but added that as a parent, I probably would want to know what experience this doctor has. Now, if this were to affect the jury, it's equally an effect of the defense counsel's statement there. But here, number one, we know that jurors are presumed to follow the instructions. And having been cautioned once and read this curative instruction twice, I think we have to presume that they did. Number two, they answered a question that had nothing to do with her experience, so that it's not a factor there. Number three, her experience was relevant to the negligence claim, and she herself testified to her lack of experience with the procedure, with this treatment, and that was extensive testimony, and it was proper for purposes of the negligence count. Number four, Dr. Denon's testimony was not infected because he was asked a general question, assume, didn't specify about experience, assume what Dr. Bernstein said was correct, and nothing about informed consent was specifically mentioned. And then finally, even if you assume the testimony should have been stricken more early, a leap that I suggest is unwarranted, nothing in the statute actually forbids Dr. Bernstein's testimony. While experience is not an element of the informed consent statute, there's no bar against testimony about lack of experience. And, Carr, in which this court adopted the patient-oriented standard for informed consent, states that a patient is not required to produce any expert medical testimony regarding what other reasonable physicians would have disclosed under the same or similar circumstances, but that doesn't mean they're prohibited
from doing so. Counsel, was the purpose of the statute to identify exactly those areas that physicians were supposed to disclose and provide some certainty
in that regard? These are the elements of it, but it doesn't indicate that anything else that a physician were to say that normally in our practices, this is what we do, is somehow forbidden. And in fact, if you worry about the patient-oriented statute, defense counsel's closing indicates this is something a parent would want to know. So I don't see how it's prejudicial, even if all the other things I have argued to this court were not correct.
Dr. Dannen did testify that the failure to inform of these alleged reasonable alternative treatments was a legal
was a departure
cause
from the standard of care.
And was a cause of the myopathy?
No, the failure is not a cause, but the failure, when there is a cause.
Some expert testified that the high dose was the cause of the myopathy.
Every expert testified to that. Right. And what happens on informed consent is you say that this is information you should have given to the patient. When the patient then says, I did not receive that information, if I had received it, I would have opted for an alternative treatment, any adverse result is then becomes a liability. Moving on to the constitutional question, unless there are any other questions on the cross appeal. Let me first correct a couple things that Mr. Roberts stated. It is true earlier this year in LeBron versus Gottlieb Memorial Hospital, the Illinois Supreme Court struck down their cap on non-economic damages in medical malpractice cases on the basis of their separation of powers provision. There was no reference to the special legislation provision. The court did not have to reach that because they found the violation of separation of powers. And Illinois, like every state in the union, presumes that legislation is constitutionally valid and that the burden is on those challenging the constitutionality to prove otherwise. In many courts, they call it a standard of beyond a reasonable doubt.
Let me ask you this, counsel. If we accept your arguments that this is the province of the jury, then what about the statute that requires a reduction in damages based on comparative negligence?
Again, that's actually taking a finding of fact of the jury and implementing it, as opposed to ignoring a fact found by the jury.
What about the statute that trebles damages?
Those are statutory causes of action unknown at common law, and that is not covered by the right to jury trial under the Constitution. That's a critical distinction that the Feltner case in the U.S. Supreme Court, a unanimous decision in 1998, makes between that and Toll, which was cited by the Hawaii Medical Association, which dealt with the Clean Water Act. The court found Toll an opposite when you have a common law cause of action. Now, one of the things that we do in evaluating the jury trial question is we take a historical test. Was this something committed under the common law to the jury's determination at the time our Constitution was promulgated in 1959? And if so, then this is the exclusive province of the jury. That's language this court has frequently used, the exclusive province of the jury. Now, we know that damages have a special place in the constellation of jury rights. We just spoke about judgment as a matter of law. You can make a determination as a trial judge that the jury misunderstood the evidence and as a matter of law, causation or liability exists. You can't do that with respect to damages. You can't say the jury made a mistake on damages, and so therefore I'm going to dictate what the right damages are, because all you're allowed to do is suggest a remitter. And if the parties accept it, then that's the amount that is at issue. But if they don't accept it, if the adverse party does not accept the remitter, they have a right to insist on a new jury trial. They have a right to jury-determined damages in all those common law causes of action that existed at law at that time. And this is a critical fact here. That's why the Georgia Supreme Court earlier this year held that their cap on non-economic damages was unconstitutional as a violation of their similar right to trial by jury. In fact, what the Feltner decision tells you with respect to the Seventh Amendment, which only applies in federal causes of action in federal court, is that when there is a jury determination of damages, jurors are the judges of damages. You have to accept that, and any other way of determining damages, unless you waive your right to trial by jury, is a violation because it lacks the substance of the common law right that was constitutionalized.
Mr. Peck, can you come back to the issue of comparative negligence? Now, why is it the legislature, which has the ability to define or limit the cause of action in the case of comparative negligence, but wouldn't have the ability to do so here?
The difference here is what you do in a comparative negligence case is you say to the jury, how much responsibility for this injury did this party have, and how much responsibility for this the injury did this party have? And the jury makes a determination, 60%, 40%. And as a result, then, when the jury says that there were X amount of compensatory damages, 60% is allocated as the jury determined here, and 40% as the jury determined here.
But why does that matter constitutionally? Why does
because,
that matter,
again, you're giving the jury the determination. With a cap, you're not telling the jury about it, a cap, because you're afraid, the studies all say that you're afraid that the jury might say, well, you know, that's unfair and we'll slip a little more damages over here. You don't tell the jury. The jury says, this is what's necessary as compensation for this plaintiff right here. This is compensatory damages. And what the legislature is saying, well, we think that's too much.
So if there were a comparative negligence case in which the jury wasn't informed of the effect of its allocation, that would be constitutionally infirm?
Again, I don't think that that's the critical question here, simply because the jury is still making a determination. It's not, you're not going to allow the judge to make the determination of allocating fault. You allow the jury to make that allocation. As long as you're implementing the jury's factual determination, then you are providing the common law right to trial by jury.
The jury doesn't know what the effect of that determination would
be. It does
not
matter whether they know or not, because, again, the jury has directed this. And it's only if you depart from that that you have violated that right to trial by jury. With respect to compensatory damages, where there is no allocation, here you're deciding to ignore this critical fact, which we have exclusively placed in the realm of the jury, and decide that instead a legislative decision, a one-size-fits-all decision for those most catastrophically injured, has to override the jury's determination. That cannot be consistent with the right to trial by jury. Now, defendants have said, well, the jury, the legislature, has the right to change the common law. Well, that is true, but they haven't changed the common law by taking away the jury's authority over damages. That is a constitutionally guaranteed right, and that they can't affect.
What about Mr. Robbins' argument that the jury did determine damages? We didn't take away the jury's determination of damages.
Well, if that was true, then you wouldn't need a remittitor practice that gives you the option of a new jury trial. If the judge can then say, well, the jury determined damages, I disagree, they gave you too much, and if you accept a 20% cut, everyone could go
home. The unconstitutionality of the statute, that it's not unconstitutional because the jury did determine damages.
No, it's unconstitutional because what you're not doing is giving effect to the jury's determination of damages, and you're not asking someone to waive their right to jury trial. They're still insisting on their right to jury trial. If they reject a remittitor, they can ask for a new jury trial, so their right hasn't ended when the jury reaches its verdict. Their right continues until there's a final judgment.
So just so I understand your position, Mr. Peck, the legislature could eliminate this cause of action altogether, and that wouldn't be a constitutional problem?
There might be a substantive due process question with respect to that. In Duke Power, which the defendants cited, Congress replaced a cause of action that you might have in the court case of a nuclear accident with the Price-Anderson Act. And the Price-Anderson Act worked by having adequate quid pro quos, as the Supreme Court said in that case. What defendants had to waive all affirmative defenses. You had a guarantee that there was a fund that guaranteed $560 million available in the case of a nuclear accident. But here's the kicker. Congress then made itself the guarantor of any excess liability So Congress would make up the difference if you had a jury verdict above the $560 million. Workers' compensation is another example of changing the common law. You take a common law cause of action that can be tried in a courtroom away from the worker, and instead you create this administrative scheme that guarantees some compensation for an injury regardless of fault, and meanwhile you've got some regularization for the defendants, and so therefore that's adequate quid pro quo, and that's why courts across the country a century ago upheld workers' compensation against substantive due process claims.
So you have to go with the substantive due process analysis.
Yeah, it would not be a jury trial, right, because you've now created a statutory remedy. And when the legislature creates a statutory remedy, then because the cause of action exists by legislative grace, they can also decide what the relief is that's appropriate.
Well, what about Mr. Robbins' argument about when our court eliminated the emotional distress for property damage? Was that an unconstitutional because we
That was an exercise of your common law authority. Now, again, the common law is a creature of court-made law. So that rests with you, and when court-made law becomes obsolete, wrong, there is a question debated in academic circles that we don't have to debate here on whether the legislature can change it or the courts can change it. There's no question the courts can change it. The law that they make, they can unmake. But at the same time, there are some restrictions on what the legislature can do, but it can, of course, replace it with a statutory cause of action or say that it's inconsistent with something else. Hartbaum laws are a good example of that. Under the common law, you could sue for loss of alienation of affection. Some courts found that the legislatures, when they abolished that cause of action, were simply implementing their equal protection rights because those laws existed only when women were considered chattel.
Mr. Peck, I noticed here that the instructions did include suffering under emotional distress under general damages, and the verdict form says pain and suffering, and this statute restricts damages for physical pain and suffering. But did you or did you not argue in your motion for new trial that therefore the jury could have awarded damages for emotional suffering?
We did indeed, and in fact the trial judge added that he believed that some emotional distress damages were included in the jury's verdict. Now there is a question. We are in disagreement about who had the responsibility for establishing the proper jury instruction and the jury sheet with respect to dividing that out. We submit, as the First Circuit, the Maryland, Texas, and California courts have all held, and we cite those in our briefs, that the obligation was on them to do so simply because they were seeking to take advantage of the cap. We were satisfied with the jury's verdict. We want the entire amount for our client. We do not want it capped. And so, therefore, there was no obligation and there's no benefit to us in that respect. And so, for that reason, the obligation fell upon them. When they failed to do so under those other precedents, they basically waive their objection and their opportunity to ask for the cap. We submit that that's a legitimate way for this court to decide this, and that would moot the constitutional question here. But we've also said that another legitimate way would be to order a new trial limited to the physical pain and suffering element to know how much of this was subject to the cap. In that instance, we would still urge you to decide the constitutional question simply because it will arise again within this case as well as others, and it will help determine trial strategy about how much resources to put into proof of physical pain and suffering.
Thank you, Mr. Peck. Mr. Robbins, you have how much time for Mr. Robbins now? 4 minutes.
Thank you. Taking the last point that Mr. Peck raised first, I suggest that you take a look at the cases which they cite saying that the burden was on us, the defendant, to propose a jury verdict form or an instruction with respect to pain and suffering and assuring the fact that suffering, mental suffering, was not included under pain and suffering. The cases cited by the plaintiffs consistently say that the, for instance, there's a Massachusetts case, which they cite, which said that the defendant was required to propose a special instruction in order to take advantage of a cap in that case. And the court said that the defendant failed to propose that particular instruction and did so at its own peril. So too, plaintiffs here submitted the verdict form. We submitted one, they submitted another. The court adopted plaintiff's special verdict form. The plaintiffs agreed to the pain and suffering and emotional distress instructions that went to the jury. So as the Primus case says, plaintiffs cannot now complain about an allegedly faulty verdict form or allegedly defective instructions which they submitted and to which they agreed. As in Primus, it was a deliberate strategy of plaintiffs in this case of which they cannot complain now. So we would submit that the verdict form which they submitted, essentially, not only did they waive any error, but they invited error. It was up to them to submit, they did submit the jury verdict form. As far as Mr. Peck's argument with regard to the attack on CAP of emotional, of pain and suffering, rather, as we pointed out in our briefs, the vast majority of cases disagree with plaintiffs in this case. And if you take a look at the Fine case, F-E-I-N, which was a recent decision of the California Supreme Court, it went through all of the rationale the plaintiffs were alleging in that case, in which they allege in this case as an attack on non-economic damages. And I might say that the California court, the California legislation strikes or limits all non-economic damages to $500,000, I think $250,000 rather. In this jurisdiction, it's only pain and suffering that's limited, that's the $375,000, and there are other components of non-economic damages which the legislature left alone. And as a matter of fact, Mr. Rosati, when he argued to the jury, was obviously trying to get the jury to award less for pain and suffering and more for other non-economic damages. That's quite clear in his closing argument. The point on causation, and Dr. Dannon, I'd like to return to for a moment, because Dr. Dannon, in my opinion, put the spear through my client's heart with respect to the informed consent argument. And that was, not as a physician, but this wasn't even a question of medicine. He testified that assuming Dr. Bernstein's testimony with respect to informed consent and what the parents should have been told, Alyssa was too young legally at the time to give informed consent. That's why we keep talking about the parents. Dr. Dannon said, well, assuming Dr. Bernstein's testimony with respect to informed consent is correct, then in my opinion, as a physician, the lack of informed consent was a legal cause of Alyssa Ray's injury. It was almost impossible to get around that, and the red light is on. So,
thank you very much, Mr. Robbins.
Thank you.
Just to address a couple items, I think Mr. Robbins misunderstands both the party presentation principle, which was what the First Circuit, the Maryland Court, the Texas Court, and the California courts that we cite in our briefs applied when they said the obligation is on the party that wants to take advantage of some statute to request the information that allows them to take advantage of that statute. It doesn't switch back and forth depending on who proposes a jury instruction. It is on the party in each of these instances who wants the cap applied. Number two, it's not invited error unless you're telling the court that some legal principle exists, the court accepts it, and then you attack them for getting that wrong. That's what invited error is. And then Mr. Robbins talked about what he called the recent decision of the California Supreme Court in Fine. I would not term a 1985 decision recent, but the court in Fine, the California Supreme Court, upheld their cap on non-economic damages against an equal protection claim only, saying that on the basis of the evidence produced and the arguments before them, that is why they were upholding it. They did not reach, and the California Supreme Court has never opined on whether there's a violation of the right to trial by jury as a result of their statute. And then finally, as we discussed earlier, Dr. Dannon's testimony on informed consent was directed towards the alternatives. He did not say anything about experience. The assumption that he was asked to make about Dr. Bernstein's testimony did not mention experience. The jury's verdict form did not mention experience. This is a canard. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. We'll take this matter under advisement. Thank you.